I know, he said. I know. And then, Harold, I'm not asking sarcastically or rhetorically. I want you to tell me. What should I do? And of course, I didn't know what to tell him. You were the one who got furthest with him. But I know you blamed yourself. I blamed myself, too. Because I did something worse than accepting it. I tolerated it. I chose to forget he was doing this because it was too difficult to find a solution. And because I wanted to enjoy him as the person he wanted us to see, even though I knew better. I told myself that I was letting him keep his dignity, while choosing to forget that for thousands of nights, he sacrificed it. I would rebuke him and try to reason with him, even though I knew those methods didn't work. And even knowing that, I didn't try something else, something more radical, something that might alienate me from him. I knew I was being a coward, because I never told Julia about that bag. I never told her what I had learned about him that night in Truro. Eventually, she found out, and it was one of the very few times I'd seen her so angry. How could you let this keep happening? She asked me. How could you let this go on for so long? She never said she held me directly responsible, but I knew she did. And how could she not? I did, too. And now here I was in his apartment, where a few hours ago, while I was lying awake, he was being beaten. I sat down on the sofa with my phone in my hand to wait for Andy's call, telling me that he was ready to be returned to me, that he was ready to be released into my care. I opened the shade across from me and sat back down and stared into the steely sky until each cloud blurred into the next, until finally I could see nothing at all, only a haze of gray as the day slowly slurred into night. Andy called at 6 that evening, 9 hours after I'd dropped him off, and met me at the door. He's asleep in the examining room, he said. And then, broken left wrist, 4 broken ribs, thank Christ no broken bones in his legs, no concussion, thank God, fractured coccyx, dislocated shoulder, which I reset, bruising all up and down his back and torso. He was kicked, clearly. But no internal bleeding. His face looks worse than it is. His eyes and nose are fine, no breaks, and I iced the bruising, which you have to do too, regularly. Lacerations on his legs, this is what I'm worried about. I've written you a script for antibiotics. I'm going to start him on a low dosage as a preventative measure, but if he mentions feeling hot or chilled, you have to let me know right away. The last thing he needs is an infection there. His back is stripped. What do you mean, stripped? I asked him. He looked impatient. Flayed, he said. He was whipped, probably with a belt, but he wouldn't tell me. I bandaged them, but I'm giving you this antibiotic ointment, and you're going to need to keep the wounds cleaned and change the dressing starting tomorrow. He's not going to want to let you, but it's too fucking bad. I wrote down all the instructions in here. He handed me a plastic bag. I looked inside. Bottles of pills, rolls of bandages, tubes of cream. These, said Andy, plucking something out, are painkillers, and he hates them. But he's going to need them. Make him take a pill every 12 hours. Once in the morning, once at night. They're going to make him woozy, so don't let him outside on his own. Don't let him lift anything. They're also going to make him nauseated, but you have to make him eat, something simple like rice and broth. Try to make him stay in his chair. He's not going to want to move around much anyway. I called his dentist and made an appointment for Monday at 9. He's lost a couple of teeth. The most important thing is that he sleeps as much as he can. I'll stop by tomorrow afternoon and every night this week. Do not let him go to work, although I don't think he'll want to. He stopped as abruptly as he'd started, and we stood there in silence. I can't fucking believe this, Andy said, finally. That fucking asshole. I want to find that fuck and kill him. I know, I said. Me too. He shook his head. He wouldn't let me report it, he said. I begged him. I know, I said. Me too. It was a shock anew to see him, and he shook his head when I tried to help him into the chair, and so we stood and watched as he lowered himself into the seat, still in his same clothes, the blood now dried into rusty continence. Thank you, Andy, he said, very quietly. I'm sorry. And Andy placed his palm on the back of his head and said nothing. By the time we got back to Green Street, it was dark. His wheelchair was, as you know, one of those very lightweight, elegant ones, one so aggressive about its user's self-sufficiency that there were no handles on it, because it was assumed that the person in it would never allow himself the indignity of being pushed by another. He had to grab the top of the backrest, which was very low, and guide the chair that way. I stopped in the entryway to turn on the lights, and we both blinked. You cleaned, he said. Well, yes, I said. Not as good a job as you would have done, I'm afraid. Thank you, he said. Of course, I said. We were quiet. Why don't I help you get changed, and then you can have something to eat? He shook his head. No, thank you. But I'm not hungry. And I can do it myself. Now he was subdued, controlled. The person I had seen earlier was gone, caged once more in his labyrinth in some little open cellar. He was always polite, but when he was trying to protect himself or assert his competency, he became more so, polite and slightly remote, as if he was an explorer among a dangerous tribe and was being careful not to find himself too involved in their goings-on. I sighed inwardly and took him to his room. I told him I'd be here if he needed me, and he nodded. I sat on the floor outside the closed door and waited. I could hear the faucets turning on and off, and then his steps, and then a long period of silence, and then the sigh of the bed as he sat on it. When I went in, he was under the covers, and I sat down next to him on the edge of the bed. Are you sure you don't want to eat anything? I asked. Yes, he said, and after a pause, he looked at me. He could open his eyes now, and against the white of the sheets, he was the loamy, fecund colors of camouflage, the jungle green of his eyes, and the streaky gold and brown of his hair, and his face, less blue than it had been this morning, and now a dark, shimmery bronze. Harold, I'm so sorry, he said. I'm sorry I yelled at you last night, and I'm sorry I caused so many problems for you. I'm sorry that— Jude, I interrupted him. You don't need to be sorry. I'm sorry. I wish I could make this better for you. He closed his eyes and opened them and looked away from me. I'm so ashamed, he said softly. I stroked his hair then, and he let me. You don't have to be, I said. You didn't do anything wrong. I wanted to cry, but I thought he might, and if he wanted to, I would try not to. You know that, right? I asked him. You know this wasn't your fault. You know you didn't deserve this. He said nothing, so I kept asking and asking until finally he gave a small nod. You know that guy is a fucking asshole, right? I asked him, and he turned his face away. You know you're not to blame, right? I asked him. You know that this says nothing about you and what you're worth. Harold, he said, please. And I stopped, although really I should have kept going. For a while we said nothing. Can I ask you a question? I said. And after a second or two, he nodded again. I didn't even know what I was going to say until I was saying it. And as I was saying it, I didn't know where it had come from, other than I suppose it was something I had always known and had never wanted to ask, because I dreaded his answer. I knew what it would be, and I didn't want to hear it. Were you sexually abused as a child? I could sense rather than see him stiffen, and under my hand, I could feel him shudder. He still hadn't looked at me, and now he rolled to his left side, moving his bandaged arm to the pillow next to him. "Jesus, Harold," he said finally. I withdrew my hand. "How old were you when it happened?" I asked. There was a pause, and then he pushed his face into the pillow. "Harold," he said, "I'm really tired. I need to sleep." I put my hand on his shoulder, which jumped, but I held on. Beneath my palm, I could feel his muscles tense, could feel that shiver running through him. "It's okay," I told him. "You don't have anything to be ashamed of," I said. "It's not your fault, Jude. Do you understand me?" But he was pretending to be asleep, though I could still feel that vibration, everything in his body alert and alarmed. I sat there for a while longer, watching him hold himself rigid. Finally, I left, closing the door behind me. I stayed for the rest of the week. You called him that night, and I answered his phone and lied to you, said something useless about an accident, heard the worry in your voice, and wanted so badly to tell you the truth. The next day you called again, and I listened outside his door as he lied to you as well. A car accident? No, not serious. What? I was up at Richard's house for the weekend. I nodded off and hit a tree. I don't know, I was tired. I've been working a lot. No, a rental. Because mine's in the shop. It's not a big deal. No, I'm going to be fine. No, you know Harold. He's just overreacting. I promise. I swear. No, he's in Rome until the end of next month. Willem, I promise. It's fine. Okay. I know. Okay. I promise. I will. You too. Bye. Mostly he was meek, tractable. He ate his soup every morning. He took his pills. They made him logy. Every morning he was in his study, working, but by 11 he was on the couch, sleeping. He slept through lunch and all afternoon, and I only woke him for dinner. You called him every night. Julia called him too. I always tried to eavesdrop, but couldn't hear much of their conversations, only that he didn't say much, which meant Julia must have been saying a great deal. Malcolm came over several times, and the Henry Youngs and Elijah and Rhodes visited as well. J.B. sent over a drawing of an iris. I had never known him to draw flowers before. He fought me, as Andy had predicted, on the dressings on his legs and back, which he wouldn't, no matter how I pleaded with and shouted at him, let me see. He let Andy, and I heard Andy say to him, "You're going to need to come uptown every other day and let me change these. I mean it." "Fine," he snapped. Lucian came to see him, but he was asleep in his study. "Don't wake him," he said, and then, peeking in at him, "Jesus." We talked for a bit, and he told me about how admired he was at the firm, which is something you never get tired of hearing about your child, whether he is 4 and in preschool and excels with clay, or is 40 and in a white shoe firm and excels in the protection of corporate criminals. "I'd say you must be proud of him, but I think I know your politics too well for that." He grinned. He liked Jude quite a bit, I could tell, and I found myself feeling slightly jealous, and then stingy for feeling jealous at all. "No," I said, "I am proud of him." I felt bad then, for my years of scolding him about Rose and Pritchard, the one place where he felt safe, the one place he felt truly weightless, the one place where his fears and insecurities banished themselves. By the following Monday, the day before I left, he looked better. His cheeks were the color of mustard, but the swelling had subsided, and you could see the bones of his face again. It seemed to hurt him a little less to breathe, a little less to speak, and his voice was less breathy, more like itself. Andy had let him have his morning pain dosage, and he was more alert, though not exactly livelier. We played a game of chess, which he won. "I'll be back on Thursday evening," I told him over dinner. I only had classes on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays that semester. "No," he said, "you don't have to." "Thank you, Harold, but really, I'll be fine." "I already bought the ticket," I said. "And anyway, Jude, you don't always have to say no, you know. Remember? Acceptance?" He didn't say anything else. "So what else can I tell you?" He went back to work that Wednesday, despite Andy's suggestion he stay home through the end of the week. And despite his threats, Andy came over every night to change his dressings and inspect his legs. Julia returned, and every weekend in October, she or I would go to New York and stay with him at Green Street. Malcolm stayed with him during the week. He didn't like it, I could tell, but we decided we didn't care what he liked, not in this manner. He got better. His legs didn't get infected, neither did his back. He was lucky, Andy kept saying. He regained the weight he had lost. By the time you came home in early November, he was almost healed. By Thanksgiving, which we had that year at the apartment in New York, so he wouldn't have to travel, his cast had been removed, and he was walking again. I watched him closely over dinner, watched him talking with Lawrence and laughing with one of Lawrence's daughters, but couldn't stop thinking of him that night. His face, when Caleb grabbed his wrist, his expression of pain and shame and fear. I thought of the day I had learned he was using a wheelchair at all. It was shortly after I had found the bag in Truro and was in the city for a conference, and he had come to the restaurant in his chair, and I had been shocked. "Why did you never tell me?" I asked. And he had pretended to be surprised, acted like he thought he had. "No," I said, "you hadn't." And finally he had told me that he hadn't wanted me to see him that way, as someone weak and helpless. "I would never think of you that way," I'd told him. And although I didn't think I did, it did change how I thought of him. It made me remember that what I knew of him was just a tiny fraction of who he was. It sometimes seemed as if that week had been a haunting, one that only Andy and I had witnessed. In the months that followed, someone would occasionally joke about it, his poor driving, his Wimbledon ambitions, and he would laugh back, make some self-deprecating comment. He could never look at me in those moments. I was a reminder of what had really happened, a reminder of what he saw as his degradation. But later, I would recognize how that incident had taken something large from him, how it had changed him, into someone else, or maybe into someone he had once been. I would see the months before Caleb as a period in which he was healthier than he'd been. He had allowed me to hug him when I saw him, and when I touched him, putting an arm around him as I passed him in the kitchen, he would let me. His hand would go on chopping the carrots before him in the same steady rhythm. It had taken 20 years for that to happen. But after Caleb, he regressed. At Thanksgiving, I had gone toward him to embrace him, but he had quickly stepped to the left, just a bit, just enough so that my arms closed around air, and there had been a second in which we looked at each other, and I knew that whatever I had been allowed just a few months ago, I would be no longer. I knew that I would have to start all over. I knew that he had decided that Caleb was right, that he was disgusting, that he had somehow deserved what had happened to him. And that was the worst thing, the most reprehensible thing. He had decided to believe Caleb, to believe him over us, because Caleb confirmed what he had always thought and always been taught. And it is always easier to believe what you already think than to try to change your mind. Later, when things got bad, I would wonder what I could have said or done. Sometimes I would think that there was nothing I could have said, that there was something that might have helped, but none of us saying it could have convinced him. I still had those fantasies. The gun, the posse, 50 West 29th Street, apartment 17J. But this time we wouldn't shoot. We would take Caleb Porter by each arm, lead him down to the car, drive him to Green Street, drag him upstairs. We would tell him what to say, and warn him that we would be just outside the door waiting in the elevator, the pistol cocked and pointed at his back. And from behind the door, we'd listen to what he said. I didn't mean any of it. I was completely wrong. The things I did, but more than that, the things I said, they were meant for someone else. Believe me, because you believed me before. You are beautiful and perfect. And I never meant what I said. I was wrong. I was mistaken. No one could ever have been more wrong than I was.
Chapter 3. Every afternoon at 4, after the last of his classes and before the first of his chores, he had a free period of an hour, but on Wednesdays he was given 2 hours. Once, he had spent those afternoons reading or exploring the grounds, but recently, ever since Brother Luke had told him he could, he had spent them all at the greenhouse. If Luke was there, he would help the brother water the plants, memorizing their names, Miltonia spectabilis, Alocasia amazonica, Asystasia gangetica, so he could repeat them back to the brother and be praised.
I think the Heliconia villergera's grown, he'd say, petting its furred bracts, and Brother Luke would look at him and shake his head.
Unbelievable, he'd say. My goodness, what a great memory you have. And he'd smile to himself, proud to have impressed the brother. If Brother Luke wasn't there, he instead passed the time playing with his things. The brother had shown him how if he moved aside a stack of plastic planters in the far corner of the room, there was a small grate, and if you removed the grate, there was a small hole beneath, big enough to hold a plastic garbage bag of his possessions. So he had unearthed his twigs and stones from under the tree and moved his haul to the greenhouse, where it was warm and humid, and where he could examine his objects without losing feeling in his hands. Over the months, Luke had added to his collection. He gave him a wafer of sea glass that the brother said was the color of his eyes, and a metal whistle that had a round little ball within it that jangled like a bell when you shook it, and a small cloth doll of a man wearing a woolen burgundy top and a belt trimmed with tiny turquoise-colored beads that the brother said had been made by a Navajo Indian and had been his when he was a boy. 2 months ago, he had opened his bag and discovered that Luke had left him a candy cane, and although it had been February, he had been thrilled. He had always wanted to taste a candy cane, and he broke it into sections, sucking each into a spear point before biting down on it, gnashing the sugar into his molars. The brother had told him that the next day he had to make sure to come right away, as soon as classes ended, because he had a surprise for him. All day he had been antsy and distracted, and although two of the brothers had hit him, Michael across the face, Peter across the backside, he had barely noticed. Only Brother David's warning, that he would be made to do extra chores instead of having his free hours if he didn't start concentrating, made him focus, and somehow he finished the day. As soon as he was outside, out of view of the monastery building, he ran. It was spring, and he couldn't help but feel happy. He loved the cherry trees, with their froth of pink blossoms, and the tulips, their glossed, improbable colors, and the new grass, soft and tender beneath him. Sometimes, when he was alone, he would take the Navajo doll and a twig he had found that was shaped like a person outside and sit on the grass and play with them. He made up voices for them both, whispering to himself, because Brother Michael had said that boys didn't play with dolls, and that he was getting too old to play anyway. He wondered if Brother Luke was watching him run. One Wednesday, Brother Luke had said, "I saw you running up here today." And as he was opening his mouth to apologize, the brother had continued,
Boy, what a great runner you are. You're so fast. And he had been literally speechless, until the brother, laughing, told him he should close his mouth. When he stepped inside the greenhouse, there was no one there.
Hello? He called out. Brother Luke?
In here, he heard, and he turned toward the little room that was appended to the greenhouse, the one stocked with the supplies of fertilizer and bottles of ionized water and a hanging rack of clippers and shears and gardening scissors and the floor stacked with bags of mulch. He liked this room, with its woodsy, mossy smell, and he went toward it eagerly and knocked. When he walked in, he was at first disoriented. The room was dark and still, but for a small flame that Brother Luke was bent over on the floor. Come closer, said the brother, and he did. Closer, the brother said, and laughed. Jude, it's okay. So he went closer, and the brother held something up and said, Surprise! And he saw it was a muffin with a lit wooden match thrust into its center.
What is it?
He asked.
It's your birthday, right?
Asked the brother. And this is your birthday cake. Go on, make a wish. Blow out the candle.
Is it for me?
He asked, as the flame guttered.
Yes, it's for you, said the brother.
Hurry, make a wish. He had never had a birthday cake before, but he had read about them, and he knew what to do. He shut his eyes and wished, and then opened them and blew out the match, and the room went completely dark. Congratulations, Luke said, and turned on the light. He handed him the muffin, and when he tried to offer the brother some of it, Luke shook his head. It's yours. He ate the muffin, which had little blueberries, and which he thought was the best thing he had ever tasted, so sweet and cakey, and the brother watched him and smiled. And I have something else for you, said Luke, and reached behind him and handed him a package, a large flat box wrapped in newspaper and tied with string. Go on, open it, Luke said, and he did, removing the newspaper carefully so it could be reused. The box was plain, faded cardboard, and when he opened it, he found it contained an assortment of round pieces of wood. Each piece was notched on both ends, and Brother Luke showed him how the pieces could be slotted within one another to build boxes, and then how he could lay twigs across the top to make a sort of roof. Many years later, when he was in college, he would see a box of these logs in the window of a toy store, and would realize that his gift had been missing parts. A red-peaked triangular structure to build a roof, and the flat green planks that lay across it. But in the moment, it had left him mute with joy, until he had remembered his manners and thanked the brother again and again. You're welcome, said Luke. After all, you don't turn 8 every day, do you?
No,
he admitted, smiling wildly at the gift, and for the rest of his free period, he had built houses and boxes with the pieces while Brother Luke watched him, sometimes reaching over to tuck his hair behind his ears. He spent every minute he could with the brother in the greenhouse. With Luke, he was a different person. To the other brothers, he was a burden, a collection of problems and deficiencies, and every day brought a new detailing of what was wrong with him. He was too dreamy, too emotional, too energetic, too fanciful, too curious, too impatient, too skinny, too playful. He should be more grateful, more graceful, more controlled, more respectful, more patient, more dexterous, more disciplined, more reverent. But to Brother Luke, he was smart, he was quick, he was clever, he was lively. Brother Luke never told him he asked too many questions, or told him that there were certain things he would have to wait to know until he grew up. The first time Brother Luke tickled him, he had gasped and then laughed uncontrollably, and Brother Luke had laughed with him, the two of them tussling on the floor beneath the orchids. You have such a lovely laugh, Brother Luke said, and what a great smile you have, Jude, and what a joyful person you are. Until it was as if the greenhouse was someplace bewitched, somewhere that transformed him into the boy Brother Luke saw, someone funny and bright, someone people wanted to be around, someone better and different than he actually was. When things were bad with the other brothers, he imagined himself in the greenhouse, playing with his things or talking to Brother Luke, and repeated back to himself the things Brother Luke said to him. Sometimes things were so bad he wasn't able to go to dinner, but the next day he would always find something in his room that Brother Luke had left him, a flower or a red leaf, or a particularly bulbous acorn, which he had begun collecting and storing under the grate. The other brothers had noticed he was spending all his time with Brother Luke, and, he sensed, disapproved. "Be careful around Luke," warned Brother Pavel of all people. Brother Pavel, who hit him and yelled at him. "He is not who you think he is." But he ignored him. They were none of them who they said they were. One day he went to the greenhouse, late. It had been a very hard week. He had been beaten very badly. It hurt him to walk. He had been visited by both Father Gabriel and Brother Matthew the previous evening, and every muscle hurt. It was a Friday. Brother Michael had unexpectedly released him early that day, and he had thought he might go play with his logs. As he always did after those sessions, he wanted to be alone. He wanted to sit in that warm space with his toys and pretend he was far away. No one was in the greenhouse when he arrived, and he lifted the grate and took out his Indian doll and the box of logs, but even as he was playing with them, he found himself crying. He was trying to cry less. It always made him feel worse, and the brothers hated it and punished him for it, but he couldn't help himself. He had at least learned to cry silently, and so he did, although the problem with crying silently was that it hurt, and it took all your concentration, and eventually he had to put his toys down. He stayed until the first bell rang, and then put his things away and ran back downhill toward the kitchen, where he would peel carrots and potatoes and chop celery for the night's meal. And then, for reasons he was never able to determine, not even when he was an adult, things suddenly became very bad. The beatings got worse, the sessions got worse, the lectures got worse. He wasn't sure what he had done. To himself, he seemed the same as he always had. But it was as if the brothers' collective patience with him were reaching some sort of end. Even brothers David and Peter, who loaned him books, as many as he wanted, seemed less inclined to speak to him. "Go away, Jude," said Brother David, when he came to talk to him about a book of Greek myths the brother had given him. "I don't want to look at you now." Increasingly, he was becoming convinced that they were going to get rid of him, and he was terrified, because the monastery was the only home he had ever had. How would he survive? What would he do in the outside world, which the brothers had told him was full of dangers and temptations? He could work, he knew that. He knew how to garden, and how to cook, and how to clean. Maybe he could get a job doing one of those things. Maybe someone else might take him in. If that happened, he reassured himself, he would be better. He wouldn't make any of the mistakes he had made with the brothers. "Do you know how much it costs to take care of you?" Brother Michael had asked him one day. "I don't think we ever thought we'd have you around for this long." He hadn't known what to say to either of those statements, and so had sat staring dumbly at the desk. "You should apologize," Brother Michael told him.
"I'm sorry," he whispered.
Now he was so tired that he didn't have strength even to go to the greenhouse. Now, after his classes, he went down to a corner of the cellar, where Brother Pavel had told him there were rats, but Brother Matthew said there weren't, and climbed onto one of the wire storage units, where boxes of oil and pasta and sacks of flour were stored, and rested, waiting until the bell rang and he had to go back upstairs. At dinners, he avoided Brother Luke, and when the brothers smiled at him, he turned away. He knew for certain now that he wasn't the boy Brother Luke thought he was. Joyful? Funny? And he was ashamed of himself, of how he had deceived Luke somehow. He had been avoiding Luke for a little more than a week, when one day he went down to his hiding place and saw the brother there, waiting for him. He looked for somewhere to hide, but there was nowhere, and instead he began to cry, turning his face to the wall and apologizing as he did. "Jude, it's all right," said Brother Luke, and stood near him, patting him on the back. "It's all right. It's all right." The brother sat on the cellar steps. "Come here. Come sit next to me," he said, but he shook his head, too embarrassed to do so. "Then at least sit down," said Luke, and he did, leaning against the wall. Luke stood then, and began looking through the boxes on one of the high shelves until he retrieved something from one and held it out to him, a glass bottle of apple juice.
"I can't,"
he said, instantly. He wasn't supposed to be in the cellar at all. He entered it through the small window on the side and then climbed down the wire shelves. Brother Pavel was in charge of the stores and counted them every week. If something was missing, he'd be blamed. He always was. "Don't worry, Jude," said the brother. "I'll replace it. Go on, take it." And finally, after some coaxing, he did. The juice was sweet as syrup, and he was torn between sipping it to make it last and gulping it in case the brother changed his mind and it was taken from him. After he had finished, they sat in silence, and then the brother said, in a low voice, "Jude, what they do to you, it's not right. They shouldn't be doing that to you. They shouldn't be hurting you." And he almost started crying again. "I would never hurt you, Jude. You know that, don't you?" And he was able to look at Luke, at his long, kind, worried face, with his short gray beard and his glasses that made his eyes look even larger, and nod.
"I know, Brother Luke," he said.
Brother Luke was quiet for a long time before he spoke next. "Do you know, Jude, that before I came here to the monastery, I had a son? You remind me so much of him. I loved him so much. But he died, and then I came here." He didn't know what to say, but he didn't have to say anything, it seemed, because Brother Luke kept talking. "I look at you sometimes and I think, you don't deserve to have these things happen to you. You deserve to be with someone else. Someone..." And then Brother Luke stopped again, because he had begun to cry again. "Jude," he said, surprised.
"Don't," he sobbed. "Please, Brother Luke, don't let them send me away. I'll be better, I promise, I promise. Don't let them send me away."
"Jude," said the brother, and sat down next to him, pulling him into his body. "No one's sending you away, I promise. No one's going to send you away." Finally, he was able to calm himself again, and the two of them sat silent for a long time. "All I meant to say was that you deserve to be with someone who loves you, like me. If you were with me, I'd never hurt you. We'd have such a wonderful time."
"What would we do?"
he asked, finally. "Well," said Luke, slowly, "we could go camping. Have you ever been camping?" He hadn't, of course, and Luke told him about it. The tent, the fire, the smell and snap of burning pine, the marshmallows impaled on sticks, the owl's hoots. The next day he returned to the greenhouse, and over the following weeks and months, Luke would tell him about all the things they might do together on their own. They would go to the beach, and to the city, and to a fair. He would have pizza and hamburgers and corn on the cob and ice cream. He would learn how to play baseball and how to fish, and they would live in a little cabin, just the two of them, like father and son. And all morning long they would read, and all afternoon they would play. They would have a garden where they would grow all their vegetables and their flowers, too. And, yes, maybe they'd have a greenhouse someday as well. They would do everything together, go everywhere together, and they would be like best friends, only better. He was intoxicated by Luke's stories, and when things were awful, he thought of them. The garden where they'd grow pumpkins and squash, the creek that ran behind the house where they'd catch perch, the cabin, a larger version of the ones he built with his logs, where Luke promised him he would have a real bed, and where even on the coldest of nights, they would always be warm, and where they could bake muffins every week. One afternoon, it was early January, and so cold that they had to wrap all the greenhouse plants in burlap, despite the heaters, they had been working in silence. He could always tell when Luke wanted to talk about their house and when he didn't, and he knew that today was one of his quiet days, when the brothers seemed elsewhere. Brother Luke was never unkind when he was in these moods, only quiet, but the kind of quiet he knew to avoid. But he yearned for one of Luke's stories. He needed it. It had been such an awful day, the kind of day in which he had wanted to die, and he wanted to hear Luke tell him about their cabin, and about all the things they would do there when they were alone. In their cabin there would be no Brother Matthew or Father Gabriel or Brother Peter. No one would shout at him or hurt him. It would be like living all the time in the greenhouse, an enchantment without end. He was reminding himself not to speak when Brother Luke spoke to him. "Jude," he said, "I'm very sad today."
"Why, Brother Luke?"
"Well," said Brother Luke, and paused. "You know how much I care for you, right? But lately, I've been feeling that you don't care for me." This was terrible to hear, and for a moment he couldn't speak.
"That's not true,"
he told the brother. But Brother Luke shook his head. "I keep talking to you about our house in the forest," he said. "But I don't get the feeling that you really want to go there. To you, they're just stories, like fairy tales." He shook his head.
"No, Brother Luke. They're real to me, too."
He wished he could tell Brother Luke just how real they were, just how much he needed them, how much they had helped him. Brother Luke looked so upset, but finally he was able to convince him that he wanted that life too, that he wanted to live with Brother Luke and no one else, that he would do whatever he needed in order to have it. And finally, the brother had smiled and crouched and hugged him, moving his arms up and down his back. "Thank you, Jude. Thank you," he said. And he, so happy to have made Brother Luke so happy, thanked him back. And then Brother Luke looked at him, suddenly serious. He had been thinking about it a lot, he said, and he thought it was time for them to build their cabin. It was time that they go away together. But he, Luke, wouldn't do it alone. Was Jude going to come with him? Did he give him his word? Did he want to be with Brother Luke the way Brother Luke wanted to be with him? Just the two of them in their small and perfect world? And of course he did. Of course he did. So there was a plan. They would leave in 2 months before Easter. He would celebrate his 9th birthday in their cabin. Brother Luke would take care of everything. All he needed to do was be a good boy and study hard and not cause any problems. And, most important, say nothing. If they found out what they were doing, Brother Luke said, then he would be sent away from the monastery, to make his way on his own, and Brother Luke wouldn't be able to help him then. He promised. The next 2 months were terrible and wonderful at the same time. Terrible because they passed so slowly. Wonderful because he had a secret. One that made his life better, because it meant his life in the monastery had an end. Every day he woke up eager, because it meant he was one day closer to being with Brother Luke. Every time one of the brothers was with him, he would remember that soon he would be far away from them, and it would be a little less bad. Every time he was beaten or yelled at, he would imagine himself in the cabin, and it would give him the fortitude, a word Brother Luke had taught him, to withstand it. He had begged Brother Luke to let him help with the preparations, and Brother Luke had told him to gather a sample of every flower and leaf from all the different kinds of plants on the monastery grounds. And so in the afternoons, he prowled the property with his Bible, pressing leaves and petals between its pages. He spent less time in the greenhouse, but whenever he saw Luke, The brother would give him one of his somber winks, and he would smile to himself, their secret something warm and delicious. The night finally arrived, and he was nervous. Brother Matthew was with him in the early evening, right after dinner, but eventually he left and he was alone. And then there was Brother Luke, holding his finger pressed to his lips, and he nodded. He helped Luke load his books and underwear into the paper bag he held open, and then they were tiptoeing down the hallway and down the stairs, and then through the darkened building and into the night. "There's just a short walk to the car," Luke whispered to him. And then, when he stopped, "Jude, what's wrong?"
"My bag," he said. "My bag from the greenhouse."
And then Luke smiled his kind smile and put his hand on his head.
"I put it in the car already," he said.
And he smiled back, so grateful to Luke for remembering. The air was cold, but he hardly noticed. On and on they walked, down the monastery's long graveled driveway, and past the wooden gates, and up the hill that led to the main road, and then down the main road itself, the night so silent it hummed. As they walked, Brother Luke pointed out different constellations, and he named them. He got them all right, and Luke murmured in admiration and stroked the back of his head.
"You're so smart," he said. "I'm so glad I picked you, Jude."
Now they were on the road, which he had only been on a few times in his life, to go to the doctor or to the dentist, although now it was empty, and little animals, muskrats and possums, gambolled before them. Then they were at the car, a long maroon station wagon, piebald with rust, its back seat filled with boxes and black trash bags, and some of Luke's favorite plants. The Cattleya Schilleriana, with its ugly speckled petals, the Hylocera sundatus, with its sleepy drooping head of a blossom, in their dark green plastic nests. It was strange to see Brother Luke in a car, stranger than being in the car itself. But stranger than that was the feeling he had, that everything had been worth it, that all his miseries were going to end, that he was going to a life that would be as good as, perhaps better than, anything he had read about in books.
"Are you ready to go?"
Brother Luke whispered to him, and grinned.
"I am,"
he whispered back. And Brother Luke turned the key in the ignition. There were two ways of forgetting. For many years he had envisioned, unimaginatively, a vault, and at the end of the day he would gather the images and sequences and words that he didn't want to think about again, and open the heavy steel door only enough to hurry them inside, closing it quickly and tightly. But this method wasn't effective. The memories seeped out anyway. The important thing, he came to realize, was to eliminate them, not just to store them. So he had invented some solutions. For small memories, little slights, insults, you relived them again and again until they were neutralized, until they became near meaningless with repetition, or until you could believe that they were something that had happened to someone else and you had just heard about it. For larger memories, you held the scene in your head like a film strip, and then you began to erase it, frame by frame. Neither method was easy. You couldn't stop in the middle of your erasing and examine what you were looking at, for example. You couldn't start scrolling through parts of it and hope you wouldn't get ensnared in the details of what had happened, because you, of course, would. You had to work at it every night until it was completely gone. Though they never disappeared completely, of course. But they were at least more distant. They weren't things that followed you, wraith-like, tugging at you for attention, jumping in front of you when you ignored them, demanding so much of your time and effort that it became impossible to think of anything else. In fallow periods, the moments before you fell asleep, the minutes before you were landing after an overnight flight, when you weren't awake enough to do work and weren't tired enough to sleep, they would reassert themselves, and so it was best to imagine then a screen of white, huge and light-lit and still, and hold it in your mind like a shield. In the weeks following the beating, he worked on forgetting Caleb. Before going to bed, he went to the door of his apartment and, feeling foolish, tried forcing his old set of keys into the locks to assure himself that they didn't fit, that he really was once again safe. He set and reset the alarm system he'd had installed, which was so sensitive that even passing shadows triggered a flurry of beeps. And then he lay awake, his eyes open in the dark room, concentrating on forgetting. But it was so difficult. There were so many memories from those months that stabbed him that he was overwhelmed. He heard Caleb's voice saying things to him. He saw the expression on Caleb's face as he had stared at his unclothed body. He felt the horrid blank airlessness of his fall down the staircase, and he crunched himself into a knot and put his hands over his ears and closed his eyes. Finally, he would get up and go to his office at the other end of the apartment and work. He had a big case coming up, and he was grateful for it. His days were so occupied that he had little time to think of anything else. For a while, he was hardly going home at all, just 2 hours to sleep and an hour to shower and change, until one evening he'd had an episode at work, a bad one, the first time he ever had. The night janitor had found him on the floor and had called the building's security department, who had called the firm's chairman, a man named Peterson Tremaine, who had called Lucian, who was the only one he had told what to do in case something like this should happen. Lucian had called Andy, and then both he and the chairman had come into the office and waited with him for Andy to arrive. He had seen them, seen their feet, and even as he had gasped and writhed on the ground, he had tried to find the energy to beg them to leave, to reassure them that he was fine, that he just needed to be left alone. But they hadn't left, and Lucian had wiped the vomit from his mouth, tenderly, and then sat on the floor near his head and held his hand, and he had been so embarrassed he had almost cried. Later he had told them again and again that it was nothing, that this happened all the time. But they had made him take the rest of the week off, and the following Monday, Lucian had told him that they were making him go home at a reasonable hour, midnight on the weekdays, 9 p.m. on the weekends. "Lucian," he'd said, frustrated, "this is ridiculous. I'm not a child." "Believe me, Jude," Lucian had said, "I told the rest of the management committee I thought we should ride you like you were an Arabian at the Preakness, but for some strange reason they're worried about your health. Also the case. For some reason they think if you get sick we won't win the case." He had fought and fought with Lucian, but it hadn't made a difference. At midnight his office lights abruptly clicked off, and he had at last resigned himself to going home when he had been told. Since the Caleb incident, he had barely been able to talk to Harold. Even seeing him was a kind of torture. This made Harold and Julia's visits, which were increasingly frequent, challenging. He was mortified that Harold had seen him like that. When he thought of it, Harold seeing his bloody pants, Harold asking him about his childhood, how obvious was he? Could people actually tell by talking to him what had happened to him so many years ago? And if so, how could he better conceal it? He was so sharply nauseated that he had to stop what he was doing and wait for the moment to pass. He could feel Harold trying to treat him the same as he had, but something had shifted. No longer did Harold harass him about Rose and Pritchard. No longer did he ask him what it was like to abet corporate malfeasance. And he certainly never mentioned the possibility that he might settle down with someone. Now his questions were about how he felt. How was he? How was he feeling? How were his legs? Had he been tiring himself out? Had he been using the chair a lot? Did he need help with anything? He always answered the exact same way. Fine, 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 no, no, no. And then there was Andy, who had abruptly reinitiated his nightly phone calls. Now he called at 1 a.m. every night, and during their appointments, which Andy had increased to every other week, he was un-Andy-ish, quiet and polite, which made him anxious. He examined his legs, he counted his cuts, he asked all the questions he always did, he checked his reflexes. And every time he got home, when he was emptying his pockets of change, he found that Andy had slipped in a card for a doctor, a psychologist named Sam Lohman, and on it had written, "First visits on me." There was always one of these cards, each time with a different note. "Do it for me, Jude." Or, "One time, that's it." They were like annoying fortune cookies, and he always threw them away. He was touched by the gesture, but also weary of it, of its pointlessness. It was the same feeling he had whenever he had to replace the bag under the sink after Harold's visits. He'd go to the corner of his closet where he kept a box filled with hundreds of alcohol wipes and bandages, stacks and stacks of gauze, and dozens of packets of razors, and make a new bag and tape it back in its proper place. People had always decided how his body would be used, and although he knew that Harold and Andy were trying to help him, the childish, obdurate part of him resisted. He would decide. He had such little control of his body anyway. How could they begrudge him this? He told himself he was fine, that he had recovered, that he had regained his equilibrium, but really he knew something was wrong, that he had been changed, that he was slipping. Willem was home, and even though he hadn't been there to witness what had happened, even though he didn't know about Caleb, about his humiliation, he had made certain of this, telling Harold and Julia and Andy that he'd never speak to them again if they said anything to anyone. He was still somehow ashamed to be seen by him. "Jude, I'm so sorry," Willem had said when he had returned and seen his cast. "Are you sure you're okay?" But the cast was nothing. The cast was the least shameful part, and for a minute he had been tempted to tell Willem the truth, to collapse against him the way he never had and start crying, to confess everything to Willem and ask him to make him feel better, to tell him that he still loved him in spite of who he was. But he didn't, of course. He had already written Willem a long email full of elaborate lies detailing his car accident, and the first night they were reunited, they had stayed up so late talking about everything but that email that Willem had slept over, the two of them falling asleep on the living room sofa. But he kept his life moving along. He got up, he went to work. He simultaneously craved company so he wouldn't think of Caleb, and dreaded it, because Caleb had reminded him how inhuman he was, how deficient, how disgusting. And he was too embarrassed to be around other people, normal people. He thought of his days the way he thought of taking steps when he was experiencing the pain and numbness in his feet. He would get through one, and then the next, and then the next, and eventually things would get better. Eventually he would learn how to fold those months into his life and accept them and keep going. He always had. The court case came, and he won. It was a huge win, Lucian kept telling him, and he knew it was, but mostly he felt panic. Now what was he going to do? He had a new client, a bank, but the work there was of the long, tedious, fact-gathering sort, not the kind of frantic work that required 20-hour days. He would be at home, by himself, with nothing but the Caleb incident to occupy his mind. Tremaine congratulated him, and he knew he should be happy. But when he asked the chairman for more work, Tremaine had laughed. "No, St. Francis," he said, "you're going on vacation. That's an order." He didn't go on vacation. He promised first Lucian and then Tremaine he would, but that he couldn't at the moment. But it was as he had feared. He would be at home, making himself dinner, or at a movie with Willem, and suddenly a scene from his months with Caleb would appear. And then there would be a scene from the home, and a scene from his years with Brother Luke, and then a scene from his months with Dr. Traylor, and then a scene from the injury, the headlights' white glare, his head jerking to the side. And then his mind would fill with images, banshees demanding his attention, snatching and tearing at him with their long, needly fingers. Caleb had unleashed something within him, and he was unable to coax the beasts back into their dungeon. He was made aware of how much time he actually spent controlling his memories, how much concentration it took, how fragile his command over them had been all along. "Are you all right?" Willem asked him one night.